clear. The tunnel entrance of the mountain had been transformed. What was once a cold, echoing passage through the rock to the base inside was now a chaotic bazaar of survival. The tunnel walls were backdrop for stations of support. On both sides of the road, those who had sought refuge after hearing Nicole's transmission manned tables, handing out needed wares to those newly arriving. When not tending to new arrivals, the tunnel functioned as a makeshift market, where those calling the mountain home bargained for and traded with each other for desired items. The air, usually smelling of ozone and diesel, was thick with the scent of unwashed bodies, dust, and the sharp, acidic tang of anxiety. But there was hope, too. Sam stood near the tunnel entrance, watching the chaos unfold. He felt like an imposter in his own skin. It had been 48 hours since the taillights of Jacob's Jeep had disappeared into the tunnel darkness, taking Nicole with him. 48 hours since she had looked him in the eye and told him he was in charge. He didn't feel in charge. He felt abandoned. The sound of heavy air brakes cut through the din of the crowd. Sam looked up, blinded by the harsh midday sun. A massive shape lumbered to a stop just beyond the tunnel entrance. It was a bus, a double-length, articulated city transit behemoth, painted a peeling, desperate white. Its windows were reinforced with welded rebar, and a jagged metal cowcatcher had been bolted to the front bumper, stained with dark, dried fluids. Over by the makeshift market stalls, Walt froze. The big islander was currently arranging a pyramid of lemons on a folding table, the bright yellow fruit a shocking contrast to the gray concrete. But at the sound of the engine, that deep-throaty diesel idle, Walt abandoned his post. A smile broke across his face, wide and genuine. It was the first time Sam had seen him smile since he watched the satellite feed of his island.
"Ooh, look at her,"
Walt murmured, wiping his hands on his apron as he walked toward the vehicle.
"Listen to that idol. That's a Detroit Diesel Series 50. She's tired, but she's singing."
Walt loved buses. In another life, before the world went quiet, he had driven a tour bus for a punk band. After the world died, he toured the country in a bus of his own. He knew the soul of a heavy machine. He walked up to the flank of the bus as it groaned to a halt, reaching out to pat the hot metal like one might stroke a horse.
"You made it, big girl," Walt whispered. "You carried them home."
The accordion doors hissed open. The smell hit first. It was a wave of stale sweat, sickness, and old fear. Then the people poured out. They didn't walk, they spilled. Men, women, children. They were gaunt, their clothes hanging off their frames like rags on scarecrows. They blinked in the day's brightness, clutching duffel bags and plastic sacks, their eyes darting around the facility with a mix of awe and terror. 100, Sam estimated, his stomach dropping. At least 100. He walked over to Ruby at her intake station and her table of clipboards, watching the stream of refugees.
"Welcome to Government Secrets,"
Sam shouted, trying to project the authority he didn't feel.
"Please keep moving. Do not stop in the entryway. If you are injured, move to the left. If you are hungry, see the big man with the fruit. Everyone else, line up at the table."
He pointed toward the folding table near the tunnel entrance where Ruby sat. She was the gatekeeper of the mountain. Her wheelchair was parked behind the table, her stack of clipboards in front of her. She looked like a judge presiding over the end of the world. The bus driver, a wiry man with shotgun slung over his shoulder and exhaustion etched into every line of his face, stumbled toward Ruby. He slapped a manifest onto the table.
102 souls, the driver croaked. "We lost 3 on the highway near Flagstaff. But the rest? We got 'em here. We heard the broadcast. You said you had room."
Ruby looked at the manifest, then at the sea of faces filling the road in front of her. She didn't blink. She just clicked her pen.
"We got room for hope," Ruby said, her voice gravelly but steady. "We'll figure out the rest. Name?"
"Miller,"
the driver said.
"All right, Miller, get in line, get some water."
As the driver moved off toward Walt's lemon stand, Ruby looked up. She locked eyes with Sam across the crowd. She jerked her head to the side, the universal signal for, "We have a problem." Sam maneuvered through the press of bodies. People reached out to touch him as he passed, begging for information, for food, for a place to sleep. He nodded, mumbled reassurances he couldn't back up, and finally reached the quiet eddy of space behind Ruby's table.
"It's 102, Ruby said, keeping her voice low so the refugees couldn't hear.
She didn't look at him. She kept writing names on a fresh sheet of paper.
"I counted," Sam said, wiping sweat from his forehead. "We can set up cots in the maintenance corridors on level 3, maybe open up the gymnasium on level 2.
"We're full, Samuel," Ruby said.
She stopped writing and looked up at him.
The harsh overhead lights reflected in her glasses.
"The gym is full. The corridors are full. We have people sleeping in the ventilation maintenance shafts. The hydroponics bay is at capacity for CO2 exchange. We put 100 more people in this rock, and the air scrubbers are going to choke."
"We can't turn them away," Sam said immediately. "We are a sanctuary. That's the mission."
"I ain't saying turn them away," Ruby snapped. "I'm saying the math don't work. This mountain, it was built for a skeleton crew of government spooks and a few generals. It wasn't built to house a city."
She gestured toward the valley beyond.
"The plan was never to live in the rock," Ruby said. "The plan was to use the rock as a shield and live in the valley. The town, the houses, the apartments, real beds, real windows."
Sam stiffened. He looked at the ground. "You know why we aren't in the town, Ruby."
"I know why Nicole decided we aren't in the town," Ruby corrected.
"Two people died," Sam said, memory rising up sharp and painful. "The clear teams, Smithy and Jenkins. They went down to clear the cul-de-sac on Elm Street. They checked the houses. They thought it was clear. But the dead, they were in the basements. They were in the walls."
"And so Nicole pulled the plug," Ruby said. "She got scared. She recalled the teams and locked the gates. Said it was too dangerous."
"It is too dangerous," Sam argued. "The valley is a funnel. The dead wander in from the highway and they get stuck in the town. It's worse now than it was 6 months ago. The density down there, it's a kill box."
"So is this," Ruby countered, tapping her clipboard against the table. "Crowding this many people into a sealed tin can? Disease creates its own kill box. Tempers flare. Resources run dry. We are suffocating, Sam. Slowly, but surely."
She pointed a gnarled finger at the crowd. A woman was weeping silently as Walt handed her a tomato. A child was sleeping on a pile of dirty laundry.
"Look at them," Ruby said. "They survived the road. They survived the hunger. You think they survived all that just to suffocate in a hallway?"
"What do you want me to do?" Sam whispered. "If I send them down to the town, I'm sending them into a meat grinder."
"I'm asking what you intend to do," Ruby said. "Not what Nicole would do."
Sam blinked. I'm just holding the line until she gets back. I'm following the protocols."
"Nicole ain't here, Sam,"
Ruby said. Her voice wasn't unkind, but it was heavy. It landed on his shoulders like a physical weight.
"She got in the Jeep and she drove away. She left. Maybe she comes back, maybe she don't. But right now, in this minute, she isn't the one looking at 100 hungry faces."
She leaned forward, her wheelchair creaking.
"She put you in charge," Ruby said. "So be in charge. Stop asking for permission from a ghost."
Sam looked at her. He wanted to argue. He wanted to say that Nicole was the leader, that she had the plan, that she was the one who kept them safe. But Nicole had lied to him. She had hidden something, packed a bag and left him holding the bag. He looked out at the crowd. He looked at the mountain walls that seemed to be closing in. Ruby was right. The math didn't work. If they stayed in the mountain, they died slowly. If they went to the town, they risked dying quickly. But the town. The town could be reclaimed, if they had the will. Sam took a deep breath. He felt the shift inside him, a terrifying, grinding gear change from follower to leader. "The intercom," Sam said. Ruby raised an eyebrow.
"What about it?"
"It's base-wide."
"It is for a fact."
Sam nodded. He walked over to the wall-mounted panel at the mouth of the tunnel. He unhooked the microphone. His hand was shaking slightly. He gripped it tighter until the shaking stopped. He pressed the button. The feedback whined through the cavern. The noise of the crowd died down instantly. Hundreds of eyes turned toward him. Walt stopped polishing a lemon. The bus driver looked up from his water.
"Attention," Sam said. His voice boomed through the speakers, echoing off the rock walls. "Attention, everyone."
He cleared his throat.
"My name is Sam. I'm the acting commander of this facility."
He paused. He waited for the sky to fall. It didn't. The crowd just waited.
"To the new arrivals," Sam continued, looking directly at the group from the bus. "Welcome home. You are safe here. We have food. We have water. We have walls."
He looked at Ruby. She was watching him, her face strong as the rock around her.
"However," Sam said, his voice hardening, "we also have a reality to face. This mountain is full. We are at capacity. But below us, in the valley, there is a town. There are homes. There is a future."
A murmur went through the crowd. The existing residents, the ones who had been there for months, exchanged nervous glances. They knew the town was forbidden. They knew about the ban.
"For the last 3 months, operations to clear the town were suspended," Sam announced. "We thought it was too dangerous. We thought we could hide in the rock and wait for the world to get better."
He paused.
"The world isn't getting better," Sam said. "So we have to make it better."
He took a breath that filled his lungs with the stale, crowded air.
"Effective immediately," Sam said. "I am reinstating the clear teams."
The gasp from those there the longest was audible. Walt dropped a lemon. It rolled across the asphalt.
"We are going to take the town back," Sam said, his voice gaining strength, fueled by the necessity of the moment. "Block by block, house by house. It will be hard work. It will be dangerous work. But it is the only way we survive."
He looked at the 100 new faces, hollowed out, traumatized, but alive.
"As you are processed by Miss Ruby," Sam said, pointing to the table, "I have a request. If you have military experience, if you have law enforcement training, or if you just have the will to fight for a real bed instead of a cot on a floor, let her know."
He leaned into the mic.
"We don't need passengers right now," Sam said. "We need a crew. We need people willing to clear the valley so our children can see the sun again."
He released the button. The silence hung for a second, heavy and profound. Then a man from the bus group, a tall guy with a scar on his cheek and a military bearing, stepped forward. He walked up to Ruby's table.
"I was a ranger," the man said. 101st Airborne. Put me on the list." "I can shoot," a woman behind him said, stepping up. "I hunted elk before this. I can shoot."
"I'm a carpenter," another man shouted. "You clear 'em, I'll board 'em up."
The line began to move. It wasn't a shuffle of refugees anymore. It was a line of volunteers. The despair in the tunnel had shifted. It had been replaced by purpose. Sam hung the microphone back on the hook. He felt lightheaded. He had just overturned Nicole's standing order. He had just authorized a mission that had gotten people killed before. He walked back to the table. Ruby was writing furiously, taking down names and skills. She paused for a second, looking up at him over the rim of her glasses. Sam looked at her, his expression tight with apprehension.
"Did I just kill us?" his eyes asked. "Did I just make a mistake?"
Ruby looked at the line of people. She looked at the ranger signing his name. She looked back at Sam. She didn't smile, but she nodded. It was a slow, solid nod of respect.
"You did what had to be done," her eyes answered. "All right, Ranger," Ruby said, her voice booming with renewed energy. "You're team lead Alpha. Stand over there by Walt. Next!"
Sam let out a breath he didn't know he was holding. He turned to look out the tunnel, past the bus, toward the valley below, where the rooftops of the town poked through the haze.
"Okay," Sam whispered to the empty air where Nicole used to stand. "We're doing it my way."
Human. Extinction level. Loss.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.